Are there any more handouts? Raise your hand if you need a handout. And okay, who can? Maybe someone can go back and. All right, thank you. Yeah, just grab a pile of them, and when he comes back in, hold your hand up, and we'll get you some. While he's doing that, let me welcome each one. It's been a long time since I've held a meeting where we had day services. I can remember in the olden days, as my kids used to say about it, that you would have it Monday through Friday day services. And so that, in fact, one time I was in a meeting and I preached 13 times. Yeah, hold up your hands, we'll get you one. I preached 13 times in 6 days. And I got home and some member where I was preaching said, "How was your vacation?" I didn't laugh, though. I didn't think it was all that funny. But anyway, it's good to do this. And we got a nice turnout for a Wednesday morning. I interrupted brother. I'm going to guess we got 75. I saw you counting.
64.
Huh? 64. Well, preachers always estimate high. But you look like 75 people. You look good. I don't know. All right. But anyway, it's good to have each one this morning, and glad you're with us in the study. We had several topics that we could have chosen from, and in fact, I sent the elders a list, and they chose this. So I'm glad we got several of the young mothers that are here, and quite a few young grandmothers that also probably have a hand in raising children. Some of you might can relate to this story that I came across when I was working on this lesson. There was a man that had gone grocery shopping for his wife, and he had his little boy with him in the grocery cart, and his kids will do when you go grocery shopping. He was thrashing around and bouncing around and not wanting to be in there, and he started kind of getting excited and hollering and screaming and crying out and all this kind of stuff, and the man kind of under his breath said, "Don't yell, Brian. Calm down, Brian. Don't get excited, Brian." Well, there was a woman that kind of notices, and she was shopping alongside, and they got to the checkout, and she said, "Young man, I really want to commend you for your attitude and for the patience that you've had with your young son, Brian." He said, "Lady, I'm Brian." So I think most of us can. Oh, some of you are just kidding now. That's a time release joke, okay? Parenting is difficult and demanding and draining, and yet it is a valuable, exciting, and a rewarding job. And so as we think about home improvement, I've entitled, is this not on, you think? Let's see if that does it. There we go. I've entitled this lesson, Raising Kids Without Raising Your Blood Pressure. Now, some of you are looking that kind of the corner of your eye like, we're not going to do that. Well, I have to kind of admit that that's a provocative title to get your attention. But to think about the idea of us being involved in parenting, being involved in child rearing, and to be able to do it in a way that is good not only for the children, but it's good for us. And I think a lot of parenting today is knee-jerk and reactionary type of parenting. And so we want to share some points this morning that will be helpful, I hope, in being responsive instead of reactionary in our parenting. And I hope this, when I get done, if you feel that what I've shared is worthy, then maybe we can make recordings of this and make it available to the many that may be working or not able to be here, that this might be of some help to them as well. So I'll do the best I can to make this something worthwhile that you can be able to use. I have 6 points this morning, and they're all going to begin with the letter A, the preacher's favorite device, alliteration. But I'm using that partially. Hopefully this will help you a little bit in remembering these, and certainly as you write them down and think about them. All right, are you ready to take notes? All right, good. The first letter, first word is the letter A, or acceptance. Acceptance. And I want us to think about this from the standpoint as we look at our children, to think about all six of these words as we have a divine model. And so what I want to do is I'll go through these six words is to make an analogy or comparison to the divine pattern we see in the Bible of the God family. And I would think there couldn't be a better model than that if we look at God's our Father, right? And we look at Jesus as he lived here on this earth. So if we could find some information in the Bible and see the way the divine God family looks at us, I think that might be helpful in our human parenting as well. So when we think about the idea of acceptance, I want to raise the question, do you love your child because of what they do or because of who they are? You see, unconditional acceptance is based on who your child is. A human being created in the image of God. One who has value and worth and dignity given to him by his creator. And acceptance is important because it develops security and it builds trust between the parent and the child. If we only focus on what a child does, and that's how they get their acceptance, then that is going to breed insecurity and a lack of self-worth. Now, acceptance is God's attitude toward us. God accepts us unconditionally. In Romans chapter 15 and verse 7, the apostle said, accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you in order to bring praise to God. And so we think about this idea of our relationship to the Lord, and we might think about God's unconditional acceptance. Do we deserve God's love? No, we don't. Do we merit the sacrifice of Jesus Christ? No, we do not. Can we earn our salvation? Absolutely not. And so when we think about God is the way he looks at us, then it is unconditional in his love, in his mercy, in his grace, and in his acceptance. Now, we live in a culture today that has developed false standards. And our children face these, and as they get older, they face some more as they go to college and get into the workplace. In fact, you and I as adults face these false standards. For instance, physical appearance. How much emphasis today is put upon physical appearance? I don't even need to document all the problems teenage girls often have in our society today that are anorexic or bulimic or something, and they're worried that they're a pound overweight. They're worried about their looks. Now, you know, if we all try to remember back when we were teenagers and we go through some of those kind of awkward times and acne and just, you know, all kinds of things and growing up, if we can relate to that, remember that, certainly there is a self-consciousness. But I think it's worse, much worse today than when I was a kid growing up. And we put so much emphasis on adults. You see these, I didn't open the article, but it was talking about some movie star that doesn't dress her age. Well, now that's shocking, and we have a movie star that's not dressing her age. She's trying to dress real young, all right? And probably by that, if I'd opened the link up, it would probably been in a modest kind of a look of a teenager or something. So our kids go to school and they deal with all of that. But then sometimes we're not helpful as parents or even grandparents because we're all worried about it and talking about it. And so we're going to the gym and working out. We're always on a weight loss program. And we buy all of these things to try to keep us looking young. Not critical of products and any help that we can get to look a little better. Not critical of that. But that is a standard of acceptance that is a challenge for our young people today. We don't want to be guilty of fostering that off on them and favoring a child because they're pretty. And one is maybe not so pretty. So that's a challenge. Or performance. We live in a very performance-driven society today. And that starts in school at a very early age. We must perform and get good grades because we've got to get into a good college. So, and then perform well so we can get out in the workforce and get a good job and perform well so we can get promotions and we can make a lot of money and we be successful. Once again, not denigrating the idea of doing the best we can and doing well. But you know, not everybody is a National Merit Scholar. Not everybody's going to make the basketball team. Not everybody's going to be the star quarterback. Not everybody is going to be in the band or the chorus. And so if we make a condition of acceptance performance-based, we are undermining the worth and the self-dignity of our children. Another is position. We live in a culture today that looks at position. What position do you hold? And again, this starts all the way down at a very young age, you're running for class president or having some position in their school of acceptance. And does it get any easier as we go along? So do we accept our children because of who they are, as our children made in the image of God, or something they've achieved in terms of position? And then possessions. I think we all understand that people judge other people in our culture by what you have. What lapel do you have inside your coat? What do you have inside your lapel? What name? What kind of car you're driving? What neighborhood you live in? And again, if we're not careful, then we begin to breed this in our children. And because of society, even if we're not, if you're taking your kids to school in a 10-year-old rusted-out Chevrolet, and the other kids are coming to school in Mercedes and Cadillacs and Lincolns, they kind of know your ship hadn't come in yet, see? And sometimes other kids will judge them. But what you dropped them off in, what kind of car you drove them to school in. In fact, I've even heard of children say, Mom, don't pull up in front of the school and they drop me off a block or two away because they're embarrassed. Hey, I've heard of that. And so that is a part of what's going on in our society today. So we need to be careful not to breed that. In Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, the wise man said, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I have come to believe over the years in study that this verse has probably been misapplied. And I'm sure I've been guilty of doing it in years gone by. And I know of parents that beat themselves up and their children are adults and they're grown and gone from home and maybe they're not faithful Christians. And they say, preacher, I must have done something wrong because the Bible says, train up a child in the way that he should go when he's old and not depart. Well, two things about that. Number one, this is an axiom. It's not 100%. These proverbs of the wise man are general ruling principles. But they're not given to something that are 100% fail-safe. In fact, there are cases where proverbs are given, and the next proverb is very opposite. And so it depends on application. Like one proverb says, answer a fool according to his folly, and the next verse says, answer not a fool according to his folly. And so it depends on the situation. And so these are axioms that we apply in life. That's one thing. I believe a parent can do the very best they can do, and their children become grown and decide to reject what they've been taught. But in the second place, I really don't think that's what that verse means anyhow. Barnes, in his commentary, says the word to train means to initiate and so educate. And he says the way that he should go means according to the tenor of his way, the path especially belonging to and especially fitted for the individual's character. The proverb enjoins the closest possible study of each child's temperament and the adaptation of his way of life to that. So the way that he should go is trying to understand our children's temperament, personality, abilities, skills, mindset, emotions, aptitude, all of those things on how do we deal with them. And you know, there's some children that, you know, you can just look at them, they've done something wrong and they start crying and they're, you discipline them. There are other children you got to take stronger measures. They're a little more stronger willed. You look at some children, and yes, they seem to get straight A's without hardly cracking a book. And you see they have an aptitude for math or for science. There are other children that maybe they show an aptitude early on for working with their hands. I've had parents tell me that they had a child at a very young age start taking things apart, just a little kid. Sometimes they couldn't get them back together, but they had an aptitude for wanting to do that sort of thing. I had a college professor that was a PhD. He was the academic dean of the college where I went, a Bible professor, a brilliant man. He could have been anything. He could have been a doctor. He was brilliant. And his son, not that he wasn't smart, but he didn't have an interest in education. He didn't want to go on and get higher degrees and be a professor. You know what he wanted to do? Be an auto mechanic. Well, we need auto mechanics. And so I don't denigrate that. I always, when I move, search out a good auto mechanic. But there would be some people that would think, oh no, he's a brilliant PhD and a college dean and professor. Wouldn't you want your son to be that? No, you want your son to be what he wants to be in his aptitude. I've had people say, is your son a preacher? No, he's a faithful Christian. And he's very evangelistic and loves the Lord. But I think he probably doesn't have the aptitude and the temperament to do the kind of things in a local work that preachers probably do. He's more suited to other things. We learned that our daughter at a very early age had an ear for music. That we started giving her piano lessons when she was 6 or 7. And one day I came in and she was playing a popular song. I knew that wasn't her little kid's book. And I said, Rochelle, where did you learn that? She said, oh, I heard it on the radio. And she was picking it out by ear. And so she played the piano and was in chorus in college and writes music. And so she has an aptitude. So that's what I'm saying. Look at your kids. Don't, if you're an athlete, don't try to force them to be an athlete. If you're a musician, don't try to force them into that. Don't force your children into a mold that they are not fitted for. So acceptance says, I love you for who you are. You are somebody special to me, and I value my relationship with you. Now, I need to pick up the pace a little bit for the other 5 A's. But I just want to spend a little time here because I believe that acceptance is so important. Number 2 is the word appreciation. Appreciation is a Bible principle. When Jesus was baptized, you remember, and God spoke from heaven, and he said, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. You remember how old Jesus was then? 30. He was 30 years old when he started his ministry. Do you remember the last time we read anything about Jesus in the Bible, how old he was? 12. When Mary and Joseph found him in the temple. What was he doing for 18 years? He was working in a carpenter shop, evidently. From what little pieces of scripture we can piece together, what people said about him. Living in Nazareth, an obscure, tiny little village that was kind of looked upon with scorn. And you think about, well, he waited till he's age 30 to do God's work. I think he was doing God's work during those 18 years. The Father said, this is my beloved Son whom I'm well pleased. Certainly, immediately at the baptism, I grant. And yet, I just want to suggest to you that through his life, as he worked and grew to manhood and increased in favor and stature with God and men, and helped his father. Can you picture Jesus working alongside Joseph in the carpenter shop and turning out shoddy work? And having someone come back to Joseph and say, that boy of yours made this, and this table's falling apart. That Jesus is the laziest. You need to fire him and get somebody. I can't picture that, can you? I can picture the father looking down with a smile and said, that's my boy. And being the example. You know, it says that Jesus is our example. And so he worked with his hands. You know, all these pictures of this fair-skinned, effeminate kind of a Jesus, I don't think so. I imagine he had rough hands, calloused, splinters in them, muscles from working in a carpenter shop. And he comes at age 30 now and is baptized and begins his ministry, and we see the acceptance of the Heavenly Father. Paul expresses his appreciation. I guess I don't have that verse on there. In Philippians chapter 1 and verse 3, when he said, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. And so I just suggest that I need to learn to appreciate my child's effort more than his accomplishment. I need to learn to appreciate him. A couple of fellows by the name of Glenn and Nelson wrote a book called Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World. And in this book, they said this, children need to feel encouraged, or children feel encouraged when we see them as assets rather than objects. We see mistakes as opportunities to learn rather than failures. And we invite participation and contributions rather than directing and demanding compliance. In other words, appreciation for the effort of the child. Sometimes when I'm doing classes locally, I make copies. I didn't do that today. But you can Google this. It's 101 ways to praise your child. And just Google that. I'm sure you could pull this up. But this is kind of neat. And in fact, I think we had it on magnets. Somehow we found them someplace and we had a magnet on our refrigerator. But think of ways that you can compliment your child. And here's just a few. Let me just read 96 or so, okay? No, not that many. Okay. You're great. You're special. Awesome. Great job. Keep up the good work. You're super. You're a great kid. I'm proud of you. You're doing a super job. Fantastic. Terrific. I knew you could do it. Great effort. You're impressive. You made my day. Perfect. Your brains and gear today. Couldn't have done it better myself. That's sensational. Hooray. Excellent. You're a great example for others. You put your best foot forward. Neat work. Beautiful job. Brilliant. You're the best. Magnificent. And on the list goes of looking for creative ways to always be praising your child. I read a book one time that I don't remember the author of it, but I never forgot this statement. He said, catch your kids doing something right. Now, what do we sometimes think of as parents? That our job is to be policemen and detectives and catch them doing something wrong. And a lot of parents walk around with that kind of mentality. And you know, they give them a job to do, and you go, I'll check up and see if you did this right. And there's some parents that are very perfectionistic, and a child can do a pretty good job, but they think they're helping them by finding the one little thing they didn't do right to make them better. No. Find the 9 out of the 10 things they did right and praise them for that, and not try to find the one little thing they did wrong. Catch your children doing something right and show appreciation. The third A is the word affection. My, when you look in the Bible, you think of the places where it talks about how God expresses his affection for his people. I mean, you go back to the Old Testament, and there's all kinds of metaphors that are used that show that. You see God as a mother hen and gathering his chicks, or as an eagle taking care of the little eaglets. Just all kinds of examples that pictures God's care and compassion. Psalm 145:9 said, the Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all that he has made. We've already talked a little bit in this series about the idea of expressing affection. But as a parent, we need to model this before our children. Now, our children don't like to be grossed out by our affection for each other. But they need to see that we love each other. They need to know that and feel good about that we are in love with each other. And we need to show that to them. Whoops, what happened here? All right, I thought I had another slide there that I didn't have. But we've gone through and we have talked about the love of a husband ought to have for a wife and a wife for a husband. In fact, in Titus, where Paul told the older women to teach the younger women to love their husbands, and the verse below it, he said, and teach them to love their children. You know, we live in a day that is hard, I think, for a lot of us to understand. I know the Bible says, and Paul talked to Timothy about the day would come in the latter days when it'd be those of that natural affection. But is it almost incomprehensible to you that a mother would harm the children? Beat her children or take the lives? And how many times have we seen in the news of mothers taking the lives of their children? Truly, we live in an age where there are those that don't have natural affection. I will say parenthetically, though, that I think when a society accepts taking the life of the unborn child, and to date over 50 million children have been slaughtered through abortion, that life is not as sacred And the reality is, really, what's the difference between a partial birth abortion and taking life of a child just before it comes from the mother's womb and taking life of the child 6 months later? I don't think in God's eyes there's any difference. And we live in a time where you have that, and it is so sad. And so we need to express affection. Let your kids know that you love them. Hug them and kiss them. I said the other day, when your kids get to be teenagers, you know, they kind of become touch-me-nots a little bit, some of them. Don't worry about that. They'll grow out of that. Just pick your times when you can show affection to them. But let them know you love them. I never forget when our son was a senior in high school. He dated a young lady, I guess almost all of his senior year, where we were living, that was very popular. She was president of the student body. She was a cheerleader on the basketball team. Just well liked. He was dating her. And I know one time they left to go out and do something, and we were telling him bye, and, you know, to be good and all that kind of stuff. You tell kids when come on dates and everything. And love you, son. And she told him later in the car, she was 18 years old. She said, I have never one time heard my dad say that he loved me. Isn't that amazing? To think that a child could be 18 years old and have never received an affirmation of love and affection from a parent. And maybe that's a little bit speaks of the old-fashioned kind of macho guy that thinks it's a little beneath him to do that, but it's not. Guys, our daughters and granddaughters, as the case may be, need to hear that we love them. Our sons need to hear that we love them and to tell them often. Well, number 4A is availability. Availability. And I popped this slide up a second ago. Do you know how to spell love? Now, that sounds funny. No, that's close, but no cigar. But you're ahead of me a little bit. It's not, obviously, it's not L-O-V-E, or I wouldn't have put it up there white. I say you spell love T-I-M-E. That you give time to your children. And Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16, Paul said to redeem the days, redeem the time, because the days are evil. And the word redeem means to make best use of or to store up and to use it in the right way. When we think about our Father, our Heavenly Father, He is near to us and close to us. Psalm 145 and verse 18 said our Heavenly Father is near to us when we call upon Him. Shouldn't we be that way as earthly fathers and mothers? That we are there for our children when they need us? That when they call on us? And so the question is, how much time do we spend with our children? Are we investing time in their lives? I came across a study. This is a little hard to believe. Cornell University did this. And they attach little microphones to children and monitor them for weeks. And they found that the average American father spent 37.7 seconds a day talking to his children. Again, it's kind of hard to believe that it could be that little amount of time. And yet, it's very easy for us to become busy and involved in our work and so on and so forth, that we neglect our children. There's a little cartoon. I wish I could find it so I could put it on PowerPoint, but I remember it. And it was at a family circus or one of those little strip comic strips. And it was the picture of a father sitting in his big chair reading the newspaper. And a little boy with his baseball mitt and ball. And the caption was, "Dad, I'll be outside getting older if you want to come and play with me." And that's what's happening. Our kids are getting older. And, one day they won't be there to play catch with and to do things with and to talk to. It's almost a cliche that no man ever said on his deathbed, "I wish I spent more time at the office." And that's for sure. This is an actual letter that Robert Raines in his book Creative Brooding reproduces that was written by a runaway son to his parents. An actual letter. Dear folks, thank you for everything, but I'm going to Chicago to try to start some kind of new life for myself. You asked me why I did those things that got me in trouble and why I gave you so much static while I was home. The answer is easy for me to give you, but I don't know if you'll understand. Remember when I was about 6 or 7 years old and I used to want you just to listen to me? I remember all the nice things you gave me for Christmas and my birthday, and I was really happy with those things for about a week. But the rest of the time during the year, all I wanted was just you. I just wanted you to listen to me like I was somebody that felt things. Because I remember when I was young, I felt things. But you were always busy and you never seemed to have time. Mom, you're a wonderful cook. And you always have everything so clean. But you were so tired from doing all those things that made you busy. But you know something, Mom? I would have liked crackers and peanut butter just as well. If only you had sat down with me for a little while during the day and said to me, tell me all about it. Maybe I can help you understand. I think all the kids who are doing so many things that grown-ups are tearing their hair out and worrying about are really looking for somebody that have time to listen a few minutes and who would really treat them like they were a grown-up, like a grown-up would, who was useful to them, you know. Well, if anybody asks you where I am, just tell them I've gone looking for somebody with time. Because I got a lot of things I want to talk about. Love to you all, your son. Fifth A is accountability. Accountability. Children need to be held accountable. And accountability has to do with two things. One is submission, and the other is obedience. And let me give you an application of this principle in Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5:21 says, submitting to one another in the fear of God. Now, we're all more familiar with the next verse because Paul tells wives to submit themselves to their own husbands as unto the Lord. And yet, in the verse prior to that, he says to submit to one another. Now, you think about that a second. If we're to submit to one another, and yet he says the wife is to submit to the husband, as Brother Schwieger used to say, that's a seemingly apparent contradiction. What does that mean? Well, let me tell you what I think it means. The wife submitting to the husband is a submission in terms of headship and authority, that God has placed him in that leadership role. But the submission to one another is a mutual submission of service and ministry, of serving the needs of one another. You know, in more recent times, even in business, there's a great deal that is written in books and taught in seminars to business leaders about what is called servant leadership. And that the fellow that's in a leadership position as a CEO or a boss is not someone that's cracking the whip and chomping on a cigar, but he's a fellow that rolls up his sleeves and gets his hands dirty and shows by example what leadership is about, but serving the needs of the people that are working for him. And you see this more and more. When we lived in Tampa, a fellow named Dan Brown moved there, not the Dan Brown that wrote the book, but this Dan Brown was brought in to be the general manager over Busch Gardens in Tampa. He was the number one man of that outfit. And he attended church where I preached, and I got to know Dan a little bit, and I asked him one time for a contribution to a Rotary function we were doing. He was very gracious enough to donate some stuff from Busch Gardens, some tickets and T-shirts and I don't know, different things like that. And so anyway, he invited me to come over and show me around Busch Gardens. And so I went to his office, you know, and he just had on a sports shirt and had a name tag on, just said Dan. Like all the other Busch Gardens employees, if you've ever been to Busch Gardens, they all have tags. He just said, Dan. And so we walked around a little bit, and as we'd walk around, and these parks are just spotless, and so Dan would see something like this on the floor, on the ground, and he would pick it up and put it in a trash can. And I thought, wow, this is the guy that's the general manager, the head honcho of this place. And he would do that. As we would walk along, he'd see anything, he'd just pick it up and put it in the trash. And you'd see other employees do that. They were probably paid a minimum wage, but Dan would do that. Then we got to the place in the gardens where he took me to eat, and there was a little bit of a line. And I thought, well, I'm with Dan. We'll get right in. No, we just got in line like everybody else. He didn't pull any punches because he was Dan Brown. And we got up to the cash register. He just used his card and paid. She could see he was an employee. But it wasn't, well, good morning, Mr. Brown, or how are you, Mr. Brown? I don't think the gal knew who he was. She did. She didn't act like it. He was just another employee. Servant leadership. And in the home, we serve the needs of one another. The husband serves the wife and submits in that sin. And the wife serves the husband. And parents the children. You think about when a child is little, he needs constant attention. And we don't expect the baby to do anything for us. The baby cries and we see if he's hungry or wet or what the problem is. And we submit to the child. And so you submit to one another. And so we need to teach our children this idea of accountability, of submission and obedience. And that we all are accountable to God. Now, I want to suggest that children need to learn in three areas. One, in terms of attitude. The children need to be responsible and accountable for their own attitudes. Now, I know children can get cranky sometimes. You know, the mother, they were on vacation, and one of the children was cranky, and she gave him a little smack on the bottom, and she said, "Now, you're going to be happy whether you like it or not." Well, that may be a little paradoxical, but children are responsible for their attitudes. They can decide to be happy. We need to teach them that. Secondly, they are responsible for their own actions, not to blame other people. Now, we are living in a culture of victimization, where we blame other people, right? When I was in Cartersburg Elementary School, you could believe they did this back then. The leaves would fall. I grew up in central Indiana. Mrs. Snodgrass was the janitor. She would burn the leaves. She would rake the leaves up in the schoolyard and burn them right there in the schoolyard. Can you imagine it happened today? But anyway, I mean, there'd be lawsuits all over the place with that. But what the teacher would say, now, when you go out for recess, you go to the back of the school. Don't be out there in the front yard where Mrs. Snodgrass is burning leaves. Stay away from the fire. Now, can kids understand that? Can six-year-olds understand that? Yeah. But what happened, we went out, and Johnny Lambert dared me to jump over it. And I'm a big, long-legged kid in the first grade even. I ran. I jumped over the fire unsinged. But Mrs. Snodgrass turned me in to Mrs. Nicholson. We come back from recess. I got called into the hallway. I thought I told you not to go out by that fire. And Mrs. Snodgrass said, "You jumped over the fire." I said, "Yeah." "Why did you do that, Kenny?" "Because Johnny Lambert dared me to." Now, she didn't let me off the hook because it was Johnny Lambert's fault. It wasn't Johnny Lambert's fault. It was Kenny Weller's fault. I became responsible that day for my actions. And that's something kids need to learn. And for the consequences. There are consequences for jumping over a fire. See, in 1956 or 7. Whatever that year was. There are consequences to that. There may not be consequences today so much. We sue the person who built the fire instead of the kid who got around. But anyway, there are consequences, and children need to learn that. All right. And that brings me down to the final A, which you've probably been wondering, what about authority? And I have saved that for last on purpose. Authority is important. And certainly Jesus is our example in submitting to authority. He said, the words I speak, I do not speak by my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the work. And over again, we see in the book of John, in the New Testament, that Jesus submitted to the authority of the Father. But I'm under the authority of the Lord, and I must be subject to His discipline. The Hebrew writer said, Hebrews 12:6, the Lord disciplines those that He loves. And so I need to teach my children that they're responsible to authority, and I need to discipline them, and they need to understand that my discipline is a sign of love. Now, there are four basic parenting styles. I only got time to bullet these for you this morning, but I give them to you for your consideration. One is an autocratic type of parenting. Do we have a backside on the sheets this morning? Is that some of these are printed on the back? Okay. All right. We have an autocratic style of parenting, and that is you do it my way or else. My way or the highway. That's right. Well, then you have the opposite of that. You have a permissive style. And a permissive style said, just do whatever you want. And then thirdly, there is a neglectful style of parenting that says, I really don't care what you do. But then there is a relational style. And a relational style of parenting says, I'm listening. I love you. I care about you. And I want to understand. But may say, but this time, we're going to do it this way because... And that is a relational approach. Josh McDowell, in his book, said rules without relationship leads to rebellion. And while we live in an age of a lot of rebellion and a lot of permissiveness as parents, I'm afraid sometimes Christians have gone to the other extreme and feel like, you know, if I rule with a rod of iron and I'm just going to lay down the law, that's the way it's going to be. Well, if you haven't built a relationship with your children, you can have all the rules in the world and they're not going to work because they're not going to respect the rules because your parenting is not relational. They may do it for a little while under fear, but there'll be a point where they bow their neck and they're going to do it their way. In fact, the Bible speaks to this. Fathers, do not overcorrect your children or make it difficult for them to obey the commandment. It is possible to overcorrect. Have you ever been driving? Maybe kind of a narrow road, and maybe you're doing what Mark is doing. You're texting, and all of a sudden you kind of go over the white line a little bit to the left, and you kind of realize it, and you correct, but you overcorrect, and now you go off on the shoulder. Sometimes people overcorrect and they go off into the ditch because they overcorrected. You can overcorrect your children and make it difficult for them to obey. Or, he put it this way in Colossians 3:21, don't exasperate your children that they may not lose heart. And so don't make it so ridiculously hard and difficult for them to obey that they want to give up and quit. Rules without relationship leads to rebellion. But Ken Welliver says relationship without rules leads to resentment. Kids do want some boundaries. They want discipline. They want to know that they're loved by that discipline. Well, these are the six A's. And you may not completely achieve the goal of not raising your blood pressure at all, but I think it's pretty good medicine, and I think it will help. Let me close with this quote. It's written by one of my favorite authors, Anonymous. And Anonymous says, 100 years from now, it will not matter what kind of car I drove, what kind of house I lived in, and how much money I had in my bank account, nor what my clothes looked like. But 100 years from now, the world may be a little better because I was important in the life of a child. And I might just add to what Anonymous said, and eternity may be a little brighter because what I did in the life of a child. May God bless us in our parenting.